In this present crisis, government is not the solution to our problem. Government is the problem.
This is the I Spy Radio Show.
You and I have a rendezvous with destiny.
Keeping an eye on big government.
We the people tell the government what to do. It doesn't tell us.
The trouble with our liberal friends is not that they're ignorant. It's just that they know so much that isn't so.
And now, here is your host, Mark Anderson.
Well, another week, another Democrat hissy fit. At the national level, Democrats have decided it's more important to take money from American citizens to fund illegal immigrants, and so they've shut down their government in protest. In Oregon, Democrats had a hissy fit, and despite only 5% of public support for it, the Democrats passed a huge tax increase to dump even more money into the black hole that is Oregon's Department of Transportation. You know, at this point, it might be cheaper to just pave our roads with actual dollar bills. We'll talk about Oregon in the second half of our show with Representative Ed Deal, what happened and what now. Because it's pretty clear that no matter how much we spend, it will never be enough to satisfy the greed of Democrats, who have become accustomed to the lifestyle of getting no end of billions every year from taxpayers. But the good news is there is common sense out there, and that's why you're seeing a lot of hissy fits. In case you missed it, Trump gave an incredibly important speech to the UN in which he condemned the UN's climate change agenda to their faces as a con job, dismissed renewable energy as all bankrupt, and vowed to withdraw from climate agreements to instead prioritize U.S. energy independence, including oil, gas, coal, and nuclear, which leaves a dilemma for those pushing green energy and climate change. Where do they go from here? Where do states and cities and utility companies go when so many were lurching green? Do they just pull the plug on those billions they'd spent? Where does the far left go for their funding now that the gush of climate change dollars flowing to their organizations has slowed to a trickle? This matters to places like Oregon and California and Washington and New York and lots of other blue states. It is billions of dollars they use to prop up a political agenda that does nothing practical for the environment and in fact causes great harm to the environment, which is easy to look past when you're the one getting the billions of dollars. Since our very first year on air, we have said that if you want to stop the far left, then take away the money they get from taxpayers. To talk about those impacts, I'd like to welcome Craig Rucker, the president of CFACT, Committee for a Constructive Tomorrow. Their website is cfact.org. Craig, it is good to talk to you today.
Well, thanks for having me on. It's always a pleasure.
Yeah, thanks again for being here. So did you guys have like a watch party at CFACT for that UN speech? I mean, there was a lot of popcorn moments.
Oh, my goodness. I've been waiting pretty much. I've been in this debate and really since the beginning of the whole climate change controversy, which began back in 1988 when NASA scientist James Hansen said he was 95% sure that man's activities were warming the planet. That, of course, moved to 98% 10 years later, with the UN saying that around the time of the Kyoto Protocol. But in our opinion, right from the beginning, we were suspicious of this. I think it is amazing that it took this long, but we'll take it. And it took, of course, a teleprompter going out for the president just to ramble on about this. And I got to tell you, I was just, I don't think the UN knew what it was in for by having that malfunction teleprompter during the president's speech before the UN. Because when he spoke from the heart, he not only spoke very convincingly, but, you know, he was spot on almost everything he said.
Yeah. So was there anything in particular that jumped out at you from his speech, something that you thought just really nailed it, that maybe broke the spell of climate change and green energy for some of those people sitting there in that audience?
Oh, my goodness. Well, there's a number of things. I mean, one of the things is he attacked the renewables as destroying Europe. And I thought that that was spot on. He said that, and he did that also when he had visited Starmer in England, I think it was about a month ago or so, where he just basically mentioned that they're, he mentioned that they were uglying up their countryside, but he also mentioned that the they're paying way too much, and they need to abandon it because their industries are leaving Europe and going to China. And it's, of course, China's exempt from pretty much everything. And he said they're ruining their economies. I thought that was spot on. He made a comment about you know, the carbon footprint being a hoax, that's what he actually used, that term, yes, a hoax, made up by people with evil intentions. Well, my goodness, having myself gone to 27 of the now about to be 30 UN climate meetings back from the beginning, I can tell you that he's spot on with that. That whole UN cabal, the WEF, the people that are driving this issue truly are hypocrites. They are people that themselves, you know, take private jets, drive limos. They want to be in charge, and they're getting gobs of money for this while they're trying to constrain the rest of the world to taking public transportation and living in tiny houses and eating not red meat. Well, they serve red meat at these conferences. I've been there. I've been invited to their dinners. And it's crazy.
Hmm. Well, one of the things that he mentioned that I thought, you know, speaking of China there, he was saying how Europe had reduced its carbon footprint by 37% at great cost to its jobs and manufacturing base, but it was completely offset by a 54% global increase in emissions, in large part due to China, which produces more carbon emissions than all other developed nations in the world combined. I mean, that's shocking. When I was listening to that, I thought, wow, I wonder how many people have never heard that fact before.
China is literally in building a new coal plant pretty much every week is coming online in China and will continue pretty much until 2030. So when China came forward right after Trump gave his speech and made a big announcement that at a future date somewhere down the road, they're going to be committed. Of course, the New York Times, the Washington Post went crazy over this stuff. But this isn't the first time that China has done that. And people that believe that, you know, you can sell them a bridge in Arizona, you know. It's absolute insanity.
Yeah.
But China, you know, is very suave on this thing. They actually are a big funder of the green movement here in the United States.
Yeah.
And of course, they do it not because of their devotion to the environment, because as anybody knows, China has anything but clean air and clean water. They don't care about the environment. They're doing it to try to gut our economic sector by funding environmental groups. They could choke off our mining, our timber. They could choke off our energy development. Their interests are very strategic in this whole climate game. It has nothing to do with the environment.
Yeah, and I think that's an important point that a lot of people just end up missing, is that it's not just they're trying to make money by selling green energy, but they are undercutting us and destroying our ability to produce as well, because green energy, you just don't get as much energy from it. You had mentioned the cabal of evil there, the UN and WEF. According to Council of Foreign Relations, the very next day after Trump's speech, China took a leading role at a UN climate summit there. President Xi said green and low carbon transition is the trend of our time, and announced a new commitment to reduce China's emissions by 2035. When I hear that, I take that as a sign that China knows their U.S. cash cow is over, but by putting it off 10 years, they're making it so the gullible keep buying. How do you take that? Do you think they're worried?
Yeah, they're exactly doing that, and they have precedent to go on, because back during the whole negotiations for the Paris Accord, this goes back to around 2015, the Obama administration prior to then was reticent to sign on to it because of criticisms by our side. Those of us who were not on Obama's side, that China wasn't involved. Well, China, in order to assuage the U.S., said that it will make vague commitments down in the future. And of course, our media bought it. The Obama administration bought it, and it worked for them. Now, of course, after that time, after they got everybody to sign on to the Paris Accord, China began a very ambitious campaign not to gut itself of its coal and fossil fuel plants, but to build faster and longer than ever, or more aggressively than ever before.
Yeah.
So, you know, the fact that they say these sorts of things, well, in the past they've said them as well and then gone the exact opposite direction as to what they're saying.
Yeah, because if they're serious, why not just start right now and not wait 10 years? All right, coming up, weaning gullible people and politicians off of green energy and climate change won't be easy. And there's a new danger from green energy you might not have heard of. We'll talk about that next with Craig Rucker. And welcome back. This is the iSpy Radio Show. I'm talking today to Craig Rucker. He's the president of CFACT. You can find out about the great work they do at CFACT.org. That's CFACT.org. So, Craig, at his UN speech, Trump had said that, quote, climate change is the greatest con job ever perpetrated on the world. He also said the carbon footprint is a hoax made up by people with evil intentions, as we said in that last segment there, and it's a con job. So that's the message it seems here from Trump. Get off green because we're not paying for it anymore. And that's going to be a problem because so much of what the far left does and the UN does is because American taxpayers pay for it. So can the green energy spending spree and funding of the far left continue if America says we're not paying another dime for that garbage? Or does it get to the point where they have put so much into it and get so little out of it that they reach a natural tipping point, you know, like bankruptcy?
You know, that's a good question. A student of history myself, I myself was in the military, and I always go by the adage that an army travels on its belly, meaning that if it doesn't have a supply, it doesn't have food in that, of course, it's not going to be able to carry out its mission. And I think that that's true. And for the most part, the United Nations, many of these green groups are relying on a lot of government monies. Of course, they have their rich foundations and wealthy individuals and billionaires that help them as well. But if without these things, they pretty much starve and go away. We see this with the renewable energy projects. This week, Trump is talking about chopping off another $7 billion earmarked mostly in blue states for renewable energy projects. That's likely to kill a bunch of them because without the government trough, the Green New Deal projects kind of go away. Well, in the case of the United Nations and everything, they got $100 billion climate fund. Not that they've ever raised anywhere near that amount. They want to move it up to half of 500 billion and maybe even up to $1 trillion over the next decade. It is all about the money. If the money is not going to be forthcoming and the U.S. cuts it, because we're a major contributor to this, I suspect you will see this issue kind of go away. It is about the money. And if it isn't about the money, then why does the UN keep coming back every year demanding more and more, and particularly for the U.S. to pay? They don't go after China. They don't go after India. They go after us, Western Europe, Japan, Australia, those nations to fork out the dough.
Yeah. In a normal business situation, you spend some money in an asset with the idea that eventually that asset would pay for itself and become profitable. And I had posed the hypothetical question in my opener, talking about green projects and the investments that these states and cities have made into these. Do they just pull the plug on those billions that they'd already spent? I mean, were they ever going to recoup the money that they spent on them?
You know, we're having that debate. Of course, we're CFACs out of Washington, D.C. We've sued the state of Virginia, neighboring Virginia, over its offshore wind project. And people are saying, you know, well, they're going through with the project anyway. They got a bunch of it constructed. We may as well. It's a dumb idea. True. It'll up rates two or threefold, you know, monthly utility rates. But, you know, since we spent so much on this stupid project, we may as well complete it and get some use out of it. Well, that's one way of looking at it. But to be totally honest with you, I think if they cut their losses, they would be much better off just getting in real electricity. Yes, it was a stupid waste of money. But you're also going to wind up spending so much more keeping these things operational. And then you don't even have decommissioning plans, which are added expenses that are usually omitted.
Yes.
And they certainly are omitted in the case of offshore wind on the East Coast. That also will crank up the cost. So I think we've done the balance sheet and shown the figures that it would actually save money as cutting your losses on the losing thing than continuing on. And we see that with electric vehicles. Of course, the president stopping that $7,500 rebate or, you know, support for it, which I think was put in during the IRA under Biden. Now the manufacturers are stuck with all these electric cars, so they're eating the $7,500. Yeah. They're going to just go ahead and give them to the consumer. Was that a good business decision? No, but better than having them sit on your lot, you know. So from my perspective, this is the type of nonsense you get into when you get massive government subsidies. People making very unsound economic decisions and carrying through with them anyway, I think ultimately hurts everything.
Yeah. Well, you know, everybody has dumb ideas, but continuing to fund a dumb idea, that's just beyond stupid, quite frankly. So there's another danger here that I think a lot of people may not be aware of. And besides the expense and harm to the environment by green energy, it turns out there's a new danger, PFAS. Per and polyfluoroalkyl substances, or PFAS, P-F-A-S. And they're known as forever chemicals because they are very slow to break down. They stay in the environment and the bodies of people and animals that eat food that is grown in contaminated areas. Studies have shown that exposure to some PFAS may be linked to harmful health effects in humans, including cancer, developmental issues, liver disease, low fertility, and hormone problems, among others. So here's a potentially really dangerous part emerging. It turns out that PFAS are in solar panels. And so where are crazed green at all costs environmentalists and politicians been slapping up solar panels? On farmlands. I mean, especially in places like Great Britain and the UK. But even right here in Oregon, we're seeing this. So do we know for sure whether solar panel PFAS are in fact leaching into farmland and then getting into food supplies?
We don't have an answer for that. I know we at CFAC have sponsored, we've created model legislation that's been picked up in places like Maine. And a state legislator there introduced it last year, and we testified on behalf in support of it, is that we need to get the data, because you got miles and miles. Some of these solar farms, if you take one north of Madison, Wisconsin, it's like 10 by 10 square miles, made largely of materials that contain PFAS, and they don't test it, test before or after or during the use of this. If you get a hailstorm, you get a tornado, you break, these things shatter. And we've seen that happen in numerous occasions around not just the United States, but around the world. A lot of these are Chinese panels, not necessarily sturdy made. And this has groundwater contamination possibility. Yes. Now, I don't personally think we have major tragedy with this stuff. I mean, but the Greens think we do. And a lot of states regulate it when it comes to fire equipment. That's where it's used quite a bit. And certainly has been used by environmentalists to go after places that do mining, where some of it is used. But somehow, when it comes to renewable energy, the green community, hear no evil, see no evil. We don't want to look at PFAS pollution. So I just find it kind of very hypocritical of them. And we support at least testing and getting the type of data you're talking about, so we know.
Right. Yeah, you would think they'd want that. And that was going to be one of my other questions about the groundwater contamination as well. So, all right, let's go and take a break. Trump used a four-letter word in his UN speech. Did you catch it? We'll talk about that next. And welcome back. We're talking today to Craig Rucker. We've been talking about the potential demise of green energy here, especially after Trump's UN speech. And this is meaning the loss of billions of dollars for blue states. And that matters in a place like Oregon because they've sold their soul to green energy. And be sure to stick around for our discussion coming up next with Ed Diehl, talking about the ODOT massive tax and spend bill that was just passed because, well, they got to make up that money somewhere. So, Craig, in that last segment there, I mentioned that Trump used a four-letter word that people may not have quite caught, but it's perhaps the most offensive word to so-called environmentalists, coal, C-O-A-L. And Trump wants to return to coal. That has to be driving these far-left environmentalists crazy. And lo and behold, the Department of Interior, they just opened 13 million acres of federal land for coal leasing and offered them a reduction in royalty rates as well. So do you see a widespread return to coal? I mean, the dilemma for the left right now is, do we go to coal or to nuclear? That's got to be like their biggest nightmare.
You know, I'm big on coal. I think it would be wonderful if we could move on this. And I know the world is using lots of coal. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, in the United States, I think a lot of the utilities, just for playing it safe, because we go back and forth between administrations, whether it's Trump and who knows if we're going to get a Gavin Newsom administration next time or who knows, you know, but
bite your tongue.
They're going a more safe route, which is natural gas. So I think if we do open coal, it's probably going to be an export industry. We used to get, back in the 90s, about 55% of our electricity generation came from coal. Today, it's more around 18%, maybe even 15%, somewhere in that area is what we use for electricity generation. So on the one hand, I hope we see a bump up of that. I think it would be good for our nation, and I think it's an excellent source of cheap and reliable energy. On the other hand, if we do produce it, I'm not entirely sure. Utilities haven't been so scared to death of trying to do it that it's been safer for them to create gas-fired plants, that it still may be an uphill battle for coal. Though I'm certainly enthusiastic about it, and maybe in some red states we'll start seeing them come back online.
Well, maybe. I have lived in some areas that use coal-fired power plants, and despite the myth that how dirty they are, you couldn't tell during winter that there was this massive coal power plant right there. It wasn't like the snow was turning black or anything like that. And I loved the cheap electricity. I mean, it was like a fifth of what I knew surrounding areas were paying. So you know, I'm all for coal. But, you know, you raise kind of an interesting point that if these utilities have been scared away from coal, one of the problems by investing so much money into green energy, it's, you know, the notion of an opportunity cost is by investing it there, you're not looking into some potential other areas like coal. And I've often wondered if maybe they could just invest some of that money into research and development for coal. They might find better ways to burn it. They may find other uses for coal that we never anticipated. But because we are so socked in and locked in onto green energy, we just never even thought to look there. So is that maybe some area to look at as far as coal is concerned?
Yeah, and I think that that's what they tried to do with the carbon sequestration thing. Unfortunately, that's a very expensive technology. It's really not necessary, and some would even argue a little dangerous. Our position on coal is that we don't think that what the Greens are hyperventilating about, CO2, is a dangerous planetary killing gas. And we welcome the Trump's administration's efforts here to roll back the endangerment finding that went after it. And if, in fact, they can roll that back, I think that's a big first step. If there's going to be a revival in coal use, which, of course, the endangerment finding is that that's what, under the Obama administration, they used to declare that CO2 gas was a pollutant and could be regulated. But CO2 is a life-giving gas. It's an essential element for life on Earth. It's something plants eat. You know, it's not a pollutant. Never should have been categorized a pollutant.
No.
And as a result of that, any efforts that we do in scientific research to address your question, as long as it's not done to limit CO2, I think we would be for it. But there's no need to get the technology. CO2 is not something that we need new science for. Put it out there. It's not harming anything. Yeah. And the major other sources of nitrogen oxide, sulfur, dioxide have already been cleaned up from scrubbers dating back to the Clean Air Act of the early 1990s. Yep. So coal fire plants are already burning. We have the cleanest coal fire plants in the entire world.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I'm hoping that there's a path forward for that because, like I said, it's very cheap, very efficient, and I love the lower utility bills. So in the time that we have left with you, now that green energy subsidies are going away, are we looking at maybe the damage that green energy has done being finally exposed? Because there's been an awful lot of environmental damage that was done getting the green. I mean, entire countrysides in China have been destroyed. And now that they're slapping up things like PFAS solar panels, which potentially could be destroying farmland, do you see cleaning up green as potentially a new cash cow, or is that entirely too much work for liberals and Marxists to go out there and clean things up?
You know, it's a good question. I know that they're not interested. There's some Native American reservations that have these wind farms that were promised great things. And then after the, you know, useful life cycle of the wind energy after a dozen or 2 years went by, they never took them down. So they're still up on the reservation, kind of rusting and looking awful. We see environmental devastation. The nation's largest solar facility, the Ivanpah plant in California, yes, now shutting down. That was open during the Obama years. And that killed, now that we actually studied it, killed about 6,000 birds a day, according to most estimates. And nobody anticipated that. So, of course, they didn't do the study, just like with the PFAS. We don't know what the impacts of a lot of these things are going to be until they're up there, but none of them are good. No. And could there be an industry that actually rises to take care of this? Let's hope so. I will say that for the most part, I think it's in the industry's interest just to leave them where they are. And a lot of these poor farmers and ranchers and property owners that put them on may be the ones themselves stuck with taking them out.
Well, maybe turn them into museums. You know, a salute to what was thought of as green energy. Unfortunately, we are beginning to clock. Greg, I want to thank you so much for your time today.
Well, thank you, Mark. It's always a pleasure to be on. I appreciate you having me on.
At a time when Oregonians are still suffering from Joe Biden's inflation that was outpacing any raises that people were getting, unless you work for the government, in which case you got a bigger than inflation raise. But the Democrats just passed their massive ODOT tax and spend bill, maybe it's to make Everyone suffers, whether you work for the government to get paid or you work to pay the government and hope that you have some left over. Because when gas prices go up, everybody gets hit. Every business gets hit. Everybody's costs go up. To talk about the impact of the ODOT tax and spend bill, formerly HB 2025 and now HB 3991, I'd like to welcome back Representative Ed Deal from House District 17, which is east of Salem. And Ed, it is great to talk to you.
You bet. Great to be here, Mark.
It would be nice if there was, I guess coming into this, there was a small part of me that was hoping that just maybe the Democrats would see the light here, but they decided to push this through at all costs, especially with so much opposition to it, which I think is the thing that surprises me. It's pretty rare that you see 95% opposed, and then one party says, we're going to do it anyway.
Yeah, it's really unbelievable, and it says a lot about the Democrat Party right now.
Yes.
They really don't care what the people think.
Mm-mm.
They're going to ram it through anyway. And it's not just the testimony that was in opposition, which was overwhelming opposition. Like you said, there's polls that were done, two of them done this year that Willamette Week reported on, that show Oregonians overwhelmingly don't want more transportation taxes. So we really have, this is a real problem. And if our legislature is not reflecting the will of the people, then it's up to the people to weigh in directly and tell them what's what. And that's what we're doing.
Well, it wasn't just not listening to the testimony, which was 95% against it, but you guys had introduced, you guys meaning Republicans, had introduced an amendment to put it to the voters, and the Democrats killed that. I mean, so much for this whole notion of Democrats being for democracy.
Yeah, yeah. We put together amendments that were more reflective of what the people wanted. Yes. And then we wanted to refer to the voters and let them decide. But no. So that's why, I've joined Senator Starr and Jason Williams with Taxpayers Coalition to do a referendum and bring this to the people and let them weigh in directly.
Yeah. Well, and I think that needs to happen, and I support you guys doing that. We'll talk about that maybe a little bit more in the next segment. Now, this last, when it was passed, it was because the House had already passed the bill, in part thanks to Representative Cyrus Javadi, who was a Republican, and now he's a Democrat. He voted for the bill, and so that removed this notion that it was all a Democrat bill, because at the time that he voted, it was Republican. He was a Republican. And then it was passed here just this week here, with Senate finally passing it. Did you attend when the Senate was in session? Did you go in the building at all?
Yes, I was there. I watched the vote go down.
So what was the mood of the Democrats there? Were they kind of like grim face executioners? They had a job to do no matter how distasteful. Were they happy? Were they joyful? I mean, or they just didn't care what people thought?
I think that they just feel that this is for our own good.
Mm.
And I think some of them sincerely do believe that Oregonians are acting like petulant children, as Representative Gamba said, and that you don't know what's good for you, so we're going to tell you what's good for you, and we're going to raise your taxes.
Wow.
I heard a lot of reasons. It was similar testimony to what we heard on the House floor, that we have no choice, we have to do this, or else our roads can be maintained. And that is just simply a false choice.
Yes.
The governor painted a false choice for us. After I gave my testimony on the floor, I talked about the false choice. I had a Democrat come to me and say that she agreed with me and that in their internal conversations, that's exactly how she described it. It's a false choice.
Well, yeah. This notion that there's no choice, that we have to do all of this spending, they've been saying that since they first introduced this. And this was at the time when it was HB 2025, it was going to be the most expensive tax increase in Oregon history. And ballpark figure, it was going to be about $14 billion. But now this last bill is about $4 billion. So if it was such an emergency in that first round and we really needed the money, it was all this crisis that we absolutely had to have this, well, where did that extra $10 billion of critically needed funds just suddenly disappear to?
Well, have you heard what the governor's saying more recently? She's saying basically this is just the beginning. She's going to come back for more money.
Wow.
But the problem is there's never enough money. There's never enough money to accomplish the agenda that they have. And at some point, you know, you run out of other people's money, right? And I think
we run out of people because they've moved.
They move. So really, I think the Dems have really overstepped their bounds here. We are still strongly opposed to this thing, and we're going to continue the fight against it.
Well, I know that now that this passed, the tax goes into effect 91 days after assignee die. And so has that officially hit yet, or are they still doing some work there at the Capitol? So they're not, no. They're still technically in session.
They did signee die yesterday.
They did. Okay. Wednesday.
The Senate signee died yesterday. Yep.
Okay. Well,
so that would put it going into effect by the end of the year, I think.
Well, just in time for Christmas. Well, I guess it would be just
in
after,
time for the holidays.
Just after Christmas. So, you know,
yeah. If happy New Year, Oregonians. You have a new tax.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, there's some issues around the timing that we'd like to talk to you about, because it sounds like the governor is set to play some games on that. We will talk about that next with Representative Ed Deal. He's with House District 17. Stay with us. And welcome back. Oregon Democrats just forced through one of the larger tax and spend bills in Oregon's history with the signing of, well, soon to be signing of the ODOT tax and spend bill, HB 3991. And so we're talking with Representative Ed Deal. He's from House District 17. That's most of Marion County, east of Salem, and some of Linn County as well. And so, Ed, going out of the break, I was talking about some of the timing that's involved here. The bill goes into effect 91 days after signee die. It's not dependent on when the governor signs it, but there is some games that she could play with that by holding off. Talk to us about the games she could play here.
Yes, the governor. So we have 90 days from signee die to gather the signatures that we need. But we can't start gathering signatures until the governor signs, until it's law. So it's a funny situation, unfortunate situation. So she could delay signing for 30 business days, and then we only get about 54 days to gather signatures. It'll be interesting to see, because you got to remember, this is an emergency, right? This is what she called an emergency session. This is an emergency to raise Oregonians' taxes. We'll see if she drags her feet on signing the thing.
Yeah, well.
But it poses a real challenge, but we're up for the challenge.
So 91 days minus 30, that's 61 days. That's and right in the middle of the holidays as well, when you're out there trying to gather a signature. I guess that's potentially good, because people will be out at stores. They're already going to be spending money on gifts and whatnot anyway. And so now the idea that they would have to feel the pinch of gas tax at that time. Of course, they don't actually feel the gas tax at that time. And that's, I think, also kind of a dilemma here, is that, you know, you're asking people to sign for a gas tax that's coming, not one that they're already experienced. So why can't you do these types of referendums after it is fully signed into law and effective? Is there some reasoning on that?
It's the way the referendum process is set up in the Constitution. It's been there since, I think, 1902. My understanding of the way it works is you have 90 days from signee die to gather the signatures, but you have 3 days after it becomes law to file a petition. So those are the windows. And, you know, that's probably why they put 91 days in on the bill. So people wouldn't see the tax while we are going out gathering signatures. But I'll tell you what, you go to the gas pump right now. It's already painful with the prices we're paying today. We have some of the highest gas prices in the country already. And now this bill is going to add even more to it. No way.
Yeah.
No way.
Well, and it impacts everybody, because, you know, even if you're not out there directly doing a lot of driving yourself, you know, maybe you have a fairly short commute or something like that. If you're buying something, it arrived on a truck. And diesel prices are going to be going up, which means when those prices go up, they then have to charge more. So you're going to see more expensive groceries, more expensive clothing, and all the rest. And this is going to have an impact on people. So it's not, you know, this is not a Democrat or Republican issue. This is entirely an Oregonian problem. And all of us have a problem with our expenses going up.
Right. This is an Oregon problem. It crosses party lines. There's nothing partisan about it. So we feel confident that there is enough concern about this that we can do a grassroots signature gathering process and get it done in the 54 days. The reason I say 54 days is because she has 30 working days to sign a bill.
Oh, well, that's even more gamesmanship there.
Yes, that's even more games that can be played.
So if you, because I assume she's not going to veto it. All of a sudden, you know, I changed my mind. I really need to take pity on these poor Oregonians.
I really doubt that. Yeah. Maybe she will veto it and say, I've had a change of heart. I want to talk to the Republicans again and figure something out that reflects the will of the people.
Now that would be
amazing, wouldn't it?
Yeah, that would be like a real Christmas miracle right there. So yeah, it's a little early for Christmas. But anyway, as far as the signature gathering goes, you said you need 100,000. That's your goal.
Yeah.
If she does hold off signing the bill, are there things that you can be doing in the meantime to prepare for that when the gun pops and you start running towards that finish line? Are there things you can be doing in the meantime?
Absolutely. We're doing them right now. So I would encourage your listeners to go to notaxor.com, notaxoregon.com. And you can sign up. There's two things you can do. You can sign up to volunteer, to indicate that you want to sign the petition. You can also donate to this cause, notaxor.com. And really what we're doing right now is we're building a broad coalition of people who are willing to help gather signatures. And our goal is to have several hundred signature gatherers across the state. And so we're building that organization right now, and we have people coming out of the woodwork volunteering to help.
Hmm. And are they, as I suspect, cutting across party lines? This is not just Republicans that are out there gathering these signatures. It's more than
this. Is not just Republicans, which is awesome.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Let's say that you guys do manage to get 100,000 signatures. When does it go on to the voters? And I mean, are you talking May election, or is it a special election in between, or is it November election?
No, it would be the November general election. So November 2026. And that's important.
Yeah.
That's really important because we do view this as a get out the vote kind of referendum.
Sure.
So that's how it's set up to show up on that election. Now, it is possible that the Democrats could pull some shenanigans and in the short session try and pass a bill that moves this measure to another election cycle, which would be awful. But I believe it's within their purview. But you talk about, you're already ramming this down the throats of Oregonians. That would be just slapping them in the face.
Yeah.
So I would be surprised if they would go that far. I really do.
If they move the date when they could have the election, what does that do to the tax? Does that still continue anyway? Or is it on? Because, again, if you get the signatures, it puts it on hold, right? The tax is not allowed to go into effect.
It puts it on hold, but, you know, they could possibly move it up. Maybe they move it up to the primary election or something like that.
Yeah.
I don't think they can move it out. They cannot move it out past the November election.
Okay. Well, you know, once again, Democrats not listening to their voters, and that's the whole reason for the referendums and the initiative process. And I'd like to talk to Ed a bit more about that coming up next. Stay with us.
It's not just a show, it's self-defense.
Well, the Democrats did it. They ignored the will of voters. 95% of people were against putting through an ODOT tax and spend bill. But who needs people like those pesky voters anyway? Not when you're in power. We've been talking with Representative Ed Deal from House District 17 about the Democrats ramming through that $4.5 billion spending spree for ODOT, and what now, including the coming referendum, to stop that from going into effect. So, Ed, the notion that politicians don't listen to people. That is nothing new. That has been going on for centuries. But it has a little bit of a unique history here in Oregon, because we were the first, as you mentioned before we got going to us, you had mentioned to us that Oregon was the first to pass this kind of thing, the idea of a referendum or initiative.
You're right. Oregon is a pioneer in a lot of ways, and one of those ways is with our initiative and referendum process. So we implemented in our constitution the ability to do direct vote by the people via initiative and referendum in 1902. And we were the first state in the nation, I believe, to actually do a referendum. And this direct vote of the people is something that has been important to Oregonians for a very long time, because they have a distrust of politicians. They have a distrust of political machines. And why? Because they don't reflect the will of the people. And that's exactly what we're seeing today, as we saw over 100 years ago. So this was a Republican reform, by the way, that was done. And I think we have a history which is amazing. We were one of the first states in the country to offer women the white right to vote. We're one of the first states in the country to do a direct vote for senators. We have a proud, long history of direct vote, giving power directly to the people. And that's part of what we call the Oregon way. Mm. And I want to see the Oregon way come back. And I think this is an opportunity to show our legislature that we don't like the political machine that the Democrats have built up over four decades of one party rule.
Yeah.
And we've had enough, and we're going to break it apart. And this is the start of that.
Well, this notion that politicians don't listen to people, we see that in things like what is going on up there in Portland, where you've got these riots that are outside the ICE building. You've got people that live in those areas that have complained about the noise, about the constant violence, about, it's just one thing after another. They try to raise their voice, and unfortunately, the politicians just ignore them. You've got the governor up there trying to do this, this mindless, oh my gosh, well, people just don't really realize what's going on there, that somehow we don't know that Portland is violent. And instead, she's up there with the cameras, surrounded by security people, I'm sure.
Yeah.
There's this photo op that, things are fine here in Portland.
Yeah. She's obviously not walking where a lot of other people walk. And what's amazing to me about the whole thing going on in Portland is this has been going on for weeks and weeks in a couple particular neighborhoods. People are dealing with noise all night, violence, crime, and the Portland leadership is not doing anything. And one lady up there, I'm sure you know, she took the city of Portland to court.
Yes.
Said, I can't get any sleep anymore because of the noise out here. She took them to court. A lady I know, Julie Parrish, represented her in court. And the judge, who's a former attorney general, Rosenblum, decided, well, yes, there is a noise ordinance law, but the city of Portland is not required to enforce their own law.
Wow.
So here's this poor lady, a citizen, being denied her rights. The city doesn't care. The governor apparently doesn't care. It's unbelievable. It's unbelievable.
Well, and the callousness with which these politicians treat everyday people. And then they turn around and try to say, yeah. Oh, well, it's all democracy and people need to be weighing in. But then when they do, it's just completely blind eye to it, deaf ears.
Well, I think a lot of them, especially in Portland, are in fear of some kind of retribution by these fringe extremist groups like Antifa, who's not just an extremist group. They're a terrorist group,
yeah.
Homegrown terrorist group.
Yes, absolutely.
And I think they live in fear of them. And so they will not act. I don't know any other reason why they would not tamp this down.
Yeah, it doesn't make sense. Yeah. Well, in the first half of our show, we had Craig Rucker on from CFACT, and the focus of that was talking about the demise of green energy and that now states are losing billions. Just recently came out that Trump has pulled the plug on $8 billion worth of green energy and whatnot. And that's going to be hitting places like Oregon pretty hard. And so it doesn't surprise me that the governor is out there talking about, well, we need another bill for more money because they're not getting the federal dollars for those green energy scams that they've been doing. Another big area is Medicaid. And I understand you're taking the lead on this.
Yeah, on the House side, I'm the vice chair for healthcare, and I also serve on human services. So I am right in the middle of all these Medicaid discussions. And so with the big beautiful bill, part of that is requiring states to verify enrollment criteria. So basically work requirements. In the simplest form, if you're going to be receiving Medicaid, you need, and you're able-bodied, you need to be working or looking for work or going through training so you can work. There's also some requirements for SNAP benefits, what used to be called food stamps. And so with those changes, there's a number of other changes to it as well, but we're talking about billions of dollars just over the next 4 to 6 years, I think $15 billion in impact to federal transfers into Oregon.
Yeah. Yeah. And they're going to have to figure out where to cover those more dollars from, which means more taxes, or they're going to have to actually start cutting some spending, which I hope at some point the latter will somehow hook onto their brains there, but I don't have a lot of hope for that. Ed, unfortunately, we're up against the clock. Thank you so much for your time.
Oh, okay. Hey, thank you.
Getting back to Trump's speech to the UN, in which he called climate change and green energy a hoax and that we're certainly not going to be funding it anymore, I especially love that Trump threw one of the left's favorite buzzwords back at them, sustainable. How many times have you heard the left talk about sustainability on things like climate change or farming or forest management? Things have to be sustainable. As if farmers and foresters don't already know that and haven't known that for centuries. Trump said both mass migration and their suicidal energy ideas will be the death of Western Europe. If something is not done immediately, this cannot be sustained. And he's right. People do not have limitless amounts of money, despite what the Democrats think about government. As we said with Ed, we'll either run out of money or we'll run out of people here in Oregon. Neither of those are sustainable. Thankfully, in Oregon, we can do something about it. But as we say every week, the best information does you no good if you don't use it. Reagan, what do you think?
I do not believe in a fate that will fall on us no matter what we do. I do believe in a fate that will fall on us if we do nothing.
It's more than a show. It's self-defense. The I Spy Radio Show.